Today's podcast is brought to you in part by our friends over at Lee Valley. If you're a woodworker, you know all about Lee Valley. They've got the amazing website and catalog filled with all the tools your workshop would ever need. And guess what? They are now in the luthery game as well. They are providing everything you would need to make a guitar, basically, from cutting out a guitar body all the way through to finish work, fret files, and everything in between. Go to LeeValley.com to hear more about their offerings. And if you do order anything from them, by all means, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Hey, gang. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Gerlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. Grab a cold one. Get a comfy seat. This is a fun episode. I'm talking to my dear friend, Skip Simmons. Skip is a amp repair guru out of Northern California. We've featured him in the magazine in the past. And I've known Skip now for 25 years. 25 years ago, I wanted to get a vintage tube receiver so that I could play records and music with style. And I sought Skip out. There was a lot of back and forth. There was a lot of trial and error. He let me try out all sorts of different amps and receivers over the course of several months. He would actually drop them off on my front porch, and I would wake up to go to work every morning and open the front door, and there'd just be three or four Scott receivers for me to try out. I eventually settled on a Fisher 400C, then ended up buying some amps off Skip, and the rest is history. But he is an incredible guy. He's a character. For years, as has been widely reported, he was repairing amps on his day job, at his day job, while working on as a drawbridge operator in the Sacramento Delta. You would walk up a flight of stairs. I believe the nearest town was Isleton, California. And there would be Skip, solder in hand, working on some old fenders and waiting for boats to come by. That was Skip's story. Anyway, Skip is now relocated. He's a little further outside of Sacramento, but he is still doing amps and has a ton of opinions. I hope you like this one. I really hope you like this one, actually, because at the end of this conversation, I had such a good time talking to Skip. I realized there was kind of a dearth of knowledge about vintage amps on the podcast front, so I invited him to start his own podcast. And yes, we're launching a brand new podcast with Skip Simmons called The Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons. And to make this podcast work, we're going to need some questions from you guys. So fire away, fretboardjournal@gmail.com. Send us your questions, whether it's something you're thinking about buying, something you're thinking about repairing, something that's bothered you about your amp, whether it's old or new. Let us know, and Skip will do his best to answer them. We're going to be posting The Truth About Vintage Amps once a month, at least it's to start, and then we'll see how it goes. And our first episode is going to be in just a few weeks, so I hope you enjoy it. Other news around here, the Fretboard Journal's Electric Guitar Annual is flying off the shelves. We are running low, so if you wanted to nab your copy here and you couldn't find it at Barnes & Noble, you better hurry up. Fretboardjournal.com. Click on the shop tab. We're going to sell out probably in a month or so. Probably in less than a month, the way things are going, actually. So act fast or go to Barnes & Noble. You might be able to find it there as well. And the Fretboard Journal's 43rd issue is just around the corner, going to press. So look for that in a couple of weeks. If you haven't subscribed yet, we would sure appreciate it. You can do so at fretboardjournal.com. And if you use the coupon code podcast, as many folks have been doing, you will save $5 off your order. And we now have 1, 2, and 3 year subscription deals. This episode of the Fretboard Journal podcast is also brought to you by our friends over at RetroFret. RetroFret is one of the coolest vintage stores around. They have all sorts of cool stuff. Guitars, amps, banjos, mandolins, you name it. Right now on their new arrivals page, I'm spying a 1950 Martin O15. It's pretty much the perfect guitar if you want to get your inner milk carton kids on. They also, on a much different scale girth-wise, have an Epiphone Emperor from 1955. That's the non-cutaway version with the 18.5-inch body. It almost looks a little comically big, but I bet it is an amazing-sounding guitar. And they have a Bourgeois AT Mahogany OM if you want something a little bit more recent. Go to retrofret.com to see their full inventory. If you do reach out to them, by all means, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Our final sponsor today is, of course, our friends over in Ireland, Loudon Guitars. In 1974, George Loudon made his first acoustic guitar and then made 4 electric guitars. And then he put away the electric side of things and became one of the world's great acoustic guitar makers, and has done very well for himself as that. But guess what? This year, he has brought back the electric guitar into his lineup. He's got the Loudon GL10. It's a single-cut mahogany guitar with Lawler Imperial pickups. And the coolest thing about this guitar is it doesn't look like a PRS. It doesn't look like a Fender. It looks like a Loudon. George Loudon is well known for his acoustic guitar aesthetic, and he somehow was able to segue that right into the world of electric. So check it out at loudonguitars.com. All right, here is my conversation with Skip Simmons. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly had a blast talking to him, and I learned a lot. Send us your questions for Skip. The Truth About Vintage Amps is going to be on iTunes shortly, and we would love to answer and field any questions you may have. Fretboardjournal@gmail.com.
What do you want to know? I think a lot of stuff to talk. I can think of lots of things to talk about.
That's why I called you, Skip. All right, where do you want to start?
I would say a couple things. One thing is that there's a new market and niche. You know, it used to be old amps and new amps. And now there's all these guys building fancy boutique amps, right? And I'm really glad I didn't get involved in that because I find my thing more enjoyable. Like repairing a lot of different kinds of guitars or amps is different than building them. And I would say that there's some really good stuff that's coming out because guys like Victoria and Matchless got people to pony up for, you know, what they considered to be high quality, you know, better stuff. And I say that's great, but boy, I sure don't want to be the first person to buy one of those things. There's still so many cool deals in the vintage market because it's so trendy, right? Ampegs are still ridiculously cheap and things, you know, still a lot of good stuff out there. And I would just caution people to make sure that what they get is sturdy if they plan on keeping it forever. You know, almost every other kind of new anything, it's all printed circuit boards. You're talking a little plastic jack that's soldered to a printed circuit board. How easy is it to get your foot, you know, around the guitar cord and yank it to one side, and that amp is done. You can't call me or anybody. It's like it's not even worth fixing. It might have cost you $1,000. So that's one thing I had to say. There's definitely a new category of stuff, and there's a lot of new tube amps that are affordable that sound good, like Blues Juniors and things like that, but they have a lifespan. They can't really be fixed, right?
Yeah. When it comes to these higher-end boutique amps, especially the ones that are kind of critically acclaimed, are you starting to get those in for repairs and open them up and go, what the heck were these guys thinking?
I do get a lot of brand new boutique amps. Both, you know, Fender does a lot of hand-wired stuff now too. And it's on its third owner and it's 5 years old. What does that tell you? You know, somebody paid a lot for, say, a Victoria Champ clone. And then the next just said, oh, this doesn't sound that great. And the next guy didn't think it sounded that great. The next guy didn't think it sounded that great. Finally, somebody brings it up here and I go, dudes, come back in 10 minutes. And, you know, and it sounds great because they just, I guess I cheated and I got to listen to a lot of what people really want to hear because I fixed so many of the great amps that I know what they're supposed to sound like. And a lot of those clony things, it's not just the schematic, you know, you got to have the ingredients. You can't just follow the recipe for your mom's stew and expect it to come out. You got to have those, those carrots she grew in the garden herself and stuff like that. So.
I've known you for, 25 years now, but I'm not sure I know exactly how you got started in this line of work. Can you give me the debrief?
When I was a kid, teenager, I had friends that I knew from school, and all of a sudden there was a band house. You know, it was a house that like 4 or 5 guys lived in, and 2 or 3 of them had already been playing guitars, you know, all their life. And they said, dude, our friend is having a party. 2 weeks, we got to get a band together and play 25 songs. And I said, oh man, I want to do that. And so I figured I could figure out how to play the bass because it only had 4 strings. So I went down and rented a Memphis P bass copy from the music store. And I started going bump, 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 But remember, I'm a model airplane guy, and I'm always also an antique kind of fiend. And even then, I knew what all the gods used. I knew what old Fenders and Tweeds, Marshalls and stuff were. So I started looking for it. And I didn't know how to fix it, but I would just buy. Our band always had old stuff, always. And I didn't really know how to optimize it or why any of it worked, but it was affordable enough that you could just go buy an amp and fire it up, and if you liked it, great, right? So I started learning how to work on guitars because I'm a mechanic, you know. I am a musician, but I don't have any chops. You know, I can play with people because I grew up doing that, but I can't play the guitar and stuff like a god. So I just naturally started fixing up guitars and amps and buying them for cheaper and fixing them up. It didn't take too long to realize that there was a lot of good guitar repairmen around, but there weren't any good amp repairmen.
There's
and
still
I knew back then. Yeah, I knew back then. I don't know, somehow I knew back then that we needed to fix this kind of stuff. You know, I always had old cars. You know, if your 66 Dodge Dart goes rowing, well, you might need a generator, but you might just need to tighten up the stupid cables on the top of the battery, right? So that's always been my approach to the amplifiers, is don't just assume that you have to change a million things for this thing to work. And it didn't take long to figure out, because I've seen so many of them, that they do work. You know, I've seen hundreds of old Fender twin reverbs and stuff that never had anything done to them, and they still work great. Right. So anyway, that's how I got into it. I was in a band, and I had about 5 years of playing quite a bit. And I got married when I was 25 or 26, and my wife already had kids, so I kind of dropped that and didn't play much music anymore. But the amp thing just kept going and going. And, you know, I worked at the drawbridges for years, and it paid terrible, but it was cool, and I had a lot of time, enforced time, like a monk, where you're just sitting there with a bunch of schematics and 4 hours to kill. And that's where I learned to do the PA heads, and that's where I did a lot of work down there. And the two incomes together, you know, somehow barely managed to do it. And then tube amps became a hobby, and dudes like Dan Torres and Gerald Weber started writing all these books and all these articles, most of which were stone wrong, and I just quietly kept doing it my way. And now those guys are out in the weeds somewhere. And if you Google amp repair, you find me. Right? For some reason, the internet. Well, I could go. Dan Torres, he moved to buy me and about up here in the foothills. And I didn't know it. But about 3 years ago, a guy called me up out of the blue, and he said he had a little silver-faced champ, and he had it at the music store in Nevada City getting it worked on by this supposed guru. But he was freaking out because it was taking forever, and the guy was going to want a lot of money. It was Dan Torres. And I got the email conversations between him printed out. The guy bought him. He was just, I mean, he was going to charge that guy, you know, $400 to fix a silver-faced champ. But he wanted $50 to install the speaker, which is like, you know, four little nuts, right? I told the guy, go get it, pay him whatever he wants and bring it over here. And I fixed it for him for free. And he charged him like $60 or $80 just to give it back to him, even though he hadn't fixed it. It was just grim. It was grim. So.
It's like, do you want me to censor this whole interview, no, or are you cool talking about these guys on the record?
You can do whatever you can. I trust you to do whatever. I normally wouldn't like name names, but I don't mind calling people out who want to take advantage of people. You know,
all right.
Yes. I was a natural kind of musician. I learned how things were supposed to sound. I patiently learned the old school way how to fix stuff. But another part of my tiny modest success is not screwing people over. You know, it's always that way. If I fix something and the guy calls me a week later and says it blew up again, I don't tell him to go take a hike. I'm more likely to get in the car. My wife finds out. She'll make me get in the car and go drive wherever and pick it up and fix it for him. Of course, all for free. And a lot of my work is mail order, where I never meet the people. You know, they send me the chassis, I send it back all over the country all the time. And once in a while you have a problem, but you've got to be able to convince people within a minute or 10 seconds, then I'm not the guy at the transmission shop. You're not going to have to battle me to get me to make it right. You know, the very first thing I would say if someone had a problem is, it's only going to cost you some time. Send me the chassis. I'll pay the shipping both ways. I'll fix it for free. It'll be perfect. And that lets the wind out of some people who think that, you know, they're going to have to battle you to get good service. So I think that's part of my thing too, you know. You have to be willing to do that. And you have to be a little bit insecure because you want people to like what you do. And you want to impress, you know, your customers. A lot of what I do is so far inside there that no one would ever look.
Makes sense.
I still make sure that, you know, I see amps that I did 25 years ago, and I want to look in there and go, yeah, nice job. I see you got the right color wire here that you replaced, right? I know it's anal, but you don't want to be a technician kind of guy unless you are a little bit anal, right? Yeah, it would terrify me to have to fix amps for like a band on the tour where it broke and you have to somehow get it going in 10 seconds. I approach it much more methodically than that, you know, do it a little bit slower. So that, and I got to say the internet, because it probably would be a NorCal thing only for me, except for the fact that the internet is out there. And I don't know how I got the Google placings I did, but I did. And so I get millions of calls from people who want their car stereos fixed and stuff like that. But that's okay. And I give them good advice. I talk to people on the phone all the time. I just had a guy send me a bottle of fancy whiskey in the mail, and I didn't, what the heck? And he wrote me a note and said I'd talk to him for about an hour one day months ago because he had inherited a bunch of guitars and amps. And I gave him some ideas about what to do with it, and he appreciated it. So even if it's somebody that I know is never going to give me a dime, I still will try not to be the guy where you hang up and go, man, I didn't learn anything. I want to be the guy that they say, oh, I feel better about that. Right. Give them some good advice. And that's the downside to the internet. There's so much information, but it is not wisdom or even knowledge. It's just information, really. And it's so hard to know what you're getting when you go on the internet and try to figure out what's wrong with your tube amp, say, for instance. So
what's on your bench right now? What are you actually working on?
Right now there is a 1980 Marshall JMP 100-watt big old head. But the fun stuff, I have a good customer up here, and he brought me 13 Ampegs, all from 1960 or older. 13, like these little jets and rockets and some of the old, what they call the Ampeg guitar amps that Tony Mottola and all those East Coast guys all played, and they are neat and really undervalued. They made little combos like Tweed Deluxes that you can't even get $600 or $800 for them. And they have old Jensens, and they're 6V6s, and they're all handmade, and they're just fantastic, right?
You're just going through them all?
Absolutely. He wanted to sell some and keep some, and they sound great, and very few West Coast guys know anything about them or ever played through any Ampegs except maybe a flip top or one of the big heads from the 70s, like the V4s, you know, sure. V4Bs, like the Rolling Stones amps. But hardly anybody's ever seen any of this old 50s stuff. And it's kind of, they're a little mellow. They're kind of tuxedo, like a Gibson compared to a Raw, Rowdy Fender. But the value is just incredible. Speaking of, there's a Gibson Falcon here. That's modded by me. That's one of the best amps that there is for your average Joe Blow guy. Vander Slice, my man, Tiny Telephone, says, if you have a recording studio and you can only have one amp, get a Gibson Falcon and have Skip fix it up, put a better speaker in it, because they're like a little Princeton reverb, but they're way more colorful. You know, they're more drunken, more Tony Joe White and less Chet Atkins, you know? And they just have...
So I've always thought of you as more of a purist who didn't want to modify amps beyond what, you know, how they left the factory. What do you actually do to these things?
Good question. Awesome question. Here's the Falcon story. they were one of the most common Gibson amps. They make gajillions of them.
Yep.
And they used to be in pawn shops everywhere. And they all sound fine because they've got this fantastic reverb and tremolo. But Gibson got in there on the various models. Each one, they figured out a way to make it sound terrible. They got in there and they put like a master... You know, they didn't want it to distort at all, right? And they put this dinky little cheap Jensen speaker in there, and they got a guy with a big arch top chomping away at that thing, and they made sure that it didn't distort. They didn't want that Gibson raw, rowdy, western swing thing. You know, they wanted it clean. So they don't get loud when they're stock. If they're serviced, properly serviced and working in stock, they sound good. But you got to turn the thing up to 10, and it sounds like it's on 3. So whichever model it is, I get in there and I change that. I find a little master volume or a goofy thing that Gibson put in there and take it out. So now you're talking more like a Tweed Deluxe, but with reverb and tremolo. If Fender had made that, it would be the most valuable Fender there is. But they never did, right? They never made anything like this. So it's a combination of a pretty good circuit, but then getting in there... Well, I got them years ago, and I said, how come this thing doesn't sound great? It should. And I figured out how to make it sound great, plus keep all the stuff it had going before. And now I've probably built, I bet through Tiny Telephone alone, I've probably built 20 of those.
Wow.
And they're just, they're the bomb, and they're still under a grand fixed up if I have one, you know, available. Oh, and the speaker is just that it was a small magnet Jensen called a C12R. And we have good, affordable, inexpensive speakers that are way more full, wider frequency response. You put that thing in there, and it just makes the amp sound bigger and fuller, and better bass, like that, than a stock speaker would have. So that's why the guy who never mods anything occasionally does mod something.
Are there other amps like that? I mean, do you have like a Champ Killer that you could cobble together?
Yes, there is. Yes. Yes, there is. I'll send anybody who's learning about tube amps and is starting to get a grip on it, I suggest that they get themselves a Silverface Fender Champ. Now, I know they're $500 or $600 now. They used to be $200, but if you compare the schematic of that thing to, say, a Tweed Champ, or better yet, a Tweed Princeton, you'll see that they're super, super, super similar, and they have a lot of circuitry in common. And yet, a Silverface Champ is an absolute snore compared to an old Tweed one. And you can make it like that. Right? When I made my own boutique amps for a while, the Retropolitan amps, they were a Tweed Princeton clone, real high-quality Tweed Princeton clone. And when I stopped making them, because who wants to buy a $1,000 little amp like that? I still kept getting requests, and it occurred to me that if somebody brought me a Silverface Champ, I could basically change the circuitry into the Tweed Princeton style like I did for the Retropolitans and charge somebody $150 for it, and it would transform that thing into from a so-so amp to just an absolute killer amp. I don't do as many of those anymore since Silverface Champs have gotten expensive, but that's something that a guy who's interested in circuitry, you just get the schematics, and you just sit there and you look at them, and you'll go, wow, if I just change this and this and this, it'll be like a Tweed amp. And trust me, it will. Fender didn't always make the best decisions, you know, especially in the 70s. And some of their stuff is just like kind of a snore.
Yeah.
And yet, just a few little parts. If Victoria had used a different value feedback resistor and put a tone control in that amp, they wouldn't be selling for $600 used. They'd be $1,200 used, but he didn't. And so they just, even though it's beautifully made, really high quality, if the sonics aren't there, people aren't going to keep them. I got sidetracked on that. So yeah, Gibson Falcons, fabulous. I won't give away my secrets on how to do that, but the Silverface Champ to Tweed Princeton conversion is something that a lot of people could handle and appreciate. And it's still a cool way to do it. If you went out and bought yourself a kit to build a tube amp like a Tweed Princeton, it would cost as much, and you'd have just a bunch of junk from China as far as parts go. Right? So I still do quite a few of those champs, and they represent a really good value as well, I think. Still really sturdy. Here's a good observation that just occurred to me. In 1975, say, Fender made, they're totally professional amps, and they're totally cheap budget student amp. They made both of them out of all the same materials, all of it. Same cabinet, handles, pots, tubes, tube sockets. Now, flash forward to today. Fender makes their absolute cheapest models the same as their amps that cost $2,000. They still have the same 29-cent jack in there, the same 5-cent fuse holder, the same printed circuit board. And you're thinking you're buying a reissue Twin Reverb, and it's going to be like a Twin Reverb. But when you open it up, it just looks like a big, giant version of the amp that costs $100 brand new from China. So, in the old days, they made the pro amps just like the student amps. And in the new days, they made it just like the student amps, only now they're junk. And Fender makes some good, fancy, hand-wired stuff. But I just did a Eric Clapton hand-wired Tremolux, and it had this low-power switch on it, factory. And when you hit the low power switch, all it did was put a giant resistor across the speaker. And it sounded terrible. Okay. It sounded like you put a blanket on it. But old EC there, maybe he was having a little heroin flashback or something. I guess he said, well, that sounds cool, man. It sounded terrible. It's completely unusable. And I think they got rid of it within, you know, pretty short time because other people besides me went, you might as well just, you know, put a blanket on it. But everybody wants it.
Were you able to fix that and make it usable, or was it hopeless?
No. That technique of lowering the power by just putting a giant resistor on it is so caveman and stupid. It just kills the frequency response of anything. So I just told the guy not to do that. don't hit the low power switch. In fact, that's a good point. Lots of new amps really want to convince you that you can get a 40-watt amp for the gig of your dreams, which you'll never have. But you can turn a little knob and it'll go down to 5 watts and 1 watt, right? And in my experience, none of that stuff sounds as good as a small amp. It just doesn't. I mean, I read a little review once in a while about this, that, or the other thing. But really, if you took a 5-watt amp, like a Tweed Champ, and compared it to your 40-watt Black Star something or other on the 5-watt setting, you just see it's all about dynamics. It's all about moving the pick a quarter of an inch on the string and being able to hear the difference coming out of the speaker. And as soon as you get too many knobs or too much modeling or too many low power switches and crap like that, that goes out the window, right? You just don't hear it. You get a good amp, you hand the guitar to 5 different people, they don't touch the amp, they all sound completely different. But you get a lot of the modern stuff, and it just has such a leveling, evening. You know, we want whatever you do to the string to jump out of that speaker instantly. And if you do something and you can't hear it, then that's not so good. Right? And those big amps are just they just don't sound that good when you turn them down to the low settings. I'd also point out, guys need to buy an amp they can use, not one for their dream. You probably run into that. You know, you got to realize if you can't play like a god, you probably don't need an old L5, right? I'm not even worthy to pick one up. And these guys, they want to play some big gig, but they never do. But yet they buy a 410 Tweed Bassman, right? And then they sit at home in their apartment and they go, man, this thing is just laying there. Well, of course, you're not using it the way it was intended. And even though people are hip to the small amps these days, that's still a problem. There's starting to be some boutique builders who are making things that really sound good, that people who've had every kind of old Fender really like.
Any particular brands that you care to mention?
There's some pretty nice sounding Carr amps, C-A-R-R. And I would have to say that I did a Victoria a few months back. The sound of the thing was actually, you know, pretty darn good, really dynamic and pretty impressive. I'm not sure if it was just accidental or what, but a closer look at the circuit usually reveals what it is. In that case, it's a Princeton Reverb with 4 EL84s.
Wow.
That's all it is. He copied the whole thing and just stuck the EL84s on there. It sounds good. but it's not quite the same. This, you know, Matchless made an impact.
Yep.
Trying to think of something else that really knocks me out for sounding good. I have to say that all the new Fender stuff sounds pretty darn good too. Reissue deluxe reverbs and Blues Deluxes and the Blues Junior and all that stuff sounds good. So there's a lot of good sounding new stuff. It's just, I like value. I like lasting value. I like resale. I hate to buy something and put it in my car and lose a third of the money right there just when the car door closes. So to me, it's still, if you know somebody that can help you get some things serviced or point you in the right direction, I think vintage stuff is still a fantastic deal. And do I have to point out that a $200 guitar through a great amp sounds fantastic?
Sure. You don't? That
it
makes perfect
does.
Sense.
And a $10 billion guitar through a junk amp is just, and I don't know how they figured it out, but it's obvious that they can make inexpensive, great guitars. If you don't mind that it's made in Mexico or in Indonesia, I mean, the stuff we can buy for $300 or $400 now is just phenomenal compared to Tyscos and old silver tones and stuff like that. You know, they're just incredible.
Yeah, sure.
Ever seen a Paul Reed Smith guitar from China?
Great.
The guy goes, I got it for $299 at Guitar Center. And I thought, holy crap, this is just a fantastic guitar. But they can't do amps sturdy and cheap because they can't do it with the CNC machine. They got to have somebody sit there and solder.
Yeah.
They just do. And all that Victoria stuff is done down at Mojo Tone out in North Carolina, where they got some women who've been there for a good 5 or 10 years, and they got the soldering down. They do a beautiful job, right? But that doesn't mean it's going to sound great, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get the sonics that you're looking for.
When it comes to repairing, like, vintage tube-wired amps, you've been at this for so long. Are they all about the same level of difficulty? Are they all pretty easy for you to wrap your head around, or are some more complex than others?
There are harder amps. You know, we all got spoiled by Fenders because they were, Leo said, if it's easy to fix, it's easy to make. And he was really obviously into the serviceability aspect. He wasn't going to make anything that you couldn't repair. But you can look at, say, a Magnetone stereo amp from the same year, and you open that thing up, and it's like, oh, my gosh, it looks like the inside of a TV set, right? Where they didn't mount the parts on a board. They didn't insulate anything. They just stuck it all together. So, yes, I tell people old Gibsons and Ampegs usually are a little more expensive because they almost always need a bunch of capacitors because they use the type that tend to go bad. Ampeg was famous for laying a big old squeeze of glue across the top of all these capacitors, which makes them even harder to get out. But I say it's still pretty affordable. We've got such great parts. You know, the twist lock can capacitors are available from Antique Electronic Supply, big problem solver. And if the guy's willing to drop 100 to 200, we can usually get almost anything running really good.
Yeah.
But
that
but
seems
yes,
like a bargain.
There's stuff that's a lot harder than Fenders. Some of those can style capacitors, they soldered to the chassis. And if you don't have a great big soldering iron, you can't even get them off. Whereas Fender was definitely like popping the hood of an old car and just seeing everything sitting right there, real accessible.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's harder ones, but I don't think there's anything so hard that you wouldn't want to be willing to buy a used amp because it would cost too much to fix it. At least not if you knew someone that, you know, wasn't going to roast you. I admit, most people pay twice as much as I charge, and they already paid that, and it still didn't work. Right? I charge very little, but I have very low overhead, and I just committed to a modest lifestyle. So I could charge a lot more. You know, people would call if I said $300 or $400. A lot of people would say, fine. But I say, well, maybe $80 if you're lucky, maybe $150 if you're not. And that they think that's fine, too, especially when there's shipping involved, you know, because they got people call me and they say, oh, man, I live in wherever. There isn't a good amp repairman there. And I try not to be a dick, but a lot of times I say, brother, there just isn't a good amp repairman there either or anywhere else. And I know there are, but you can't find them, the good ones. the ones that advertise and the guys that say, I'm the amp repair shop. Boy, almost all of that stuff I see and I just go, oh no, this is terrible. The Tone Quest guy seems competent. Jeff Bakos, B-A-K-O-S.
Okay.
That he's their boy, you know, that they have do stuff on all their Tone Quest gear. He just looks like a long-haired old stoner guy who's into keeping things original, right? So that's he's a potentially good place that could be somewhere somebody could go. I think he's out in Atlanta or somewhere like that. But everybody else is just costs a fortune, and I don't fix it.
Can you be a good amp repair guy without being a bit of a hoarder when it comes to stockpiling all these parts?
Yes.
Okay.
You don't have to have old parts. I could build an amp like a Tweed amp from all brand new parts and have it sound pretty doggone good. But old parts do make a difference. And if you really listen, I got a young guy named August Graybosch. He makes amps called Otis. I should pimp them slightly. Otis Amps. I think he has otisamp.com. But like Otis Elevators. And he's young and has a lot of energy to burn. And he would heat circuit and then he'd experiment with three or four different types of 0.001 capacitors in this one spot. And with young ears, you can really hear a difference. And that's what Dumble did. Everything he made, he sat there and dinked with after he made it and jerked it around, changed this and that until he liked it. And you can't do that with a production thing, really. And vintage parts are great. You know, if they're reliable, there's two things. One is you can make your old amp more original, and the other thing is that they can sound really good, right? I get a lot of Tweeds that have already been recapped with orange drops, and I'll put in some of the old Vitamin Q oil caps for a harp player, or the Pyramids, or some old Mallories for a guitar player, and then the thing just sounds like we're talking more responsive, better, more sensitivity to what you do on the guitar, you know, being mirrored as it comes out. So you don't have to have old parts. You don't have to have vintage tubes. You can do a lot with new stuff, but you're still going to want to put your ears on and, you know, really listen. And I'm spoiled. When I was building amps, somebody would bring me a real Tweed Deluxe, and I'd service it and fire it up and go, oh, man, the stuff I made doesn't sound that good. And so you got to figure out, you got to hear it. I would recommend for anybody starting out, you got to have one guitar and one cabinet. That's another one of my things that I did because I was poor that turned out to be a real blessing, is I fixed 5,000 amps, and I've played every classic amp you can imagine with my old Silvertone guitar with a dearmament and a 112 cabinet that I made from an old PV amp. And eliminating those variables is huge.
Yeah, right? That makes sense.
I mean, I've had 500 Princeton Reverbs that I've played through that. So when somebody sends me their chassis, I'm going to know what it sounds like, or I'm going to know what it's supposed to sound like.
Yeah, that makes
right?
sense.
So that is for sure. And I also say, if you're going to buy new books, the value in them is really schematics. If you're going to listen to some amp tech talk about how to fix amps, the only book is that old one, the Jack Dar book, the Electric Guitar Amplifier Handbook. That was published back in the 60s and 70s. And it's been reprinted. And that's knowledge in the printed part. But the other books, you know, they can really lead you down the wrong road. Like, you don't have to have a new old stock Holy Grail black plate something or other, or your amp won't sound good. But people buy into that,
yeah.
And they end up spinning their wheels, you know, pretty hard.
You mentioned Dumble a minute ago. Have you had to work on many Dumble amps?
One, two, four. Four or five.
Yeah, and is there genius in there, you think?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. The first one, the oldest one I did was still a Fender. You know, he lived like in Santa Cruz and he modified Fenders. And the first one I did, I think, was a Brown Super. And I got to see what he did to a Fender circuit. And then I did two or three of the famous ones. And what they've got going on is another knob that controls the distortion in a way that most amps don't. In other words, it gives you a wide range of distortion at a certain volume. It's that ratio knob, some sort of clean to dry mix thing.
Is that the FET thing?
Not all of them use that, but yes. It's a thing that he has where you can actually like mess with the gain, the whole structure of it, more than you can with a regular amp. You know, normally you got a master volume and a volume, and you just dink with those two things, and that controls clean to just hyper distorted. Well, he has another thing that really affects the sound of the distortion, and it's pretty natural, right? I don't think we need to run out and buy one. I also think it's kind of a cheap shot that all these people buy them and copy them. And I'm sure he's kind of a nut job, and I'm not sure they're really worth all that much money. But he definitely, I think what's going on there is a guy, you know, like a guy. It's not a circuit. It's the guy. He sat there. They have lots of orange drops in there. And I just told you that those are terrible in Fenders usually, but not when he did it. And all of his parts on the amps I saw, totally run-of-the-mill. You know, all 70s Fender parts, 70s, you know, transformers and just regular old stuff. Not any unobtainable parts at all. And everyone I've ever seen looked like he built it and then he dinked with it a lot after that. And I think that's probably his key. He's probably got really good ears and good taste in music, even if he is kind of, you know, maybe a, you know, a little full of himself, right? But I think the key is he sits around with his favorite guitar and plays them for a while and listens to it, as opposed to just cranking it out, right? You know, cranking it out, it sure helps to have heard a bunch of the good stuff. I think being in a band when I was a kid was a huge leg up. A lot of amp guys are such geeky tech dudes, they were never in a band at all. And older guys who learned in the Air Force, they look at some of this stuff and they go, oh, this is wrong. This is stupid. We should change this. This is a dumb way to do it, because they're electronic engineers and they know better, right? And you don't want to do that either, because we already have evidence that that way works. If somebody's going to tell you that they're going to improve it, I say you're only going to change it. It's not an improvement. It's just a change. That's what I call mods to a classic amp. If you like it when it's done, well, then I guess it's an improvement.
Sure.
But otherwise, it's just a change. And I take out far more modifications that I put into amps.
Are you still doing the vocal PA heads?
PA heads are never going to be made again. They're getting harder and harder to find. Again, the trendy aspect has caught a hold of even that. And there's a brand, Masco, that I can't even get anymore. The harmonica players especially, they just blew those things out of the water for price. Kind of like DeArmond amps, right? I had a friend with 15 of those. We took a picture at the guitar show with 15 DeArmonds, and all of a sudden that Tone Quest and they were all started going for like $2,000-$3,000, and next thing you know, you can't get that anymore. And that's what happened to Masco's. But there's a lot of other brands, and I don't advertise that stuff because I don't want to. I wait until somebody already has the bug, you know? Because it's a weird thing. You know, you come home and you tell your wife, look what I got. And she goes, what? You paid how much for that thing? It just looks like a rusty old gray toolbox. So it doesn't appeal to everyone. I've had customers for years and years and years that have never wanted one. But I also have customers that I've built, you know, 10 or 15 PA heads for. And somehow, if you look it up, what are the classic harp amps in the last few years, one of them suddenly became a Masco MA-17, specially built by me, because I made so many of them for the big dogs like Kim Wilson and guys like that, and they just latched onto it. So, but I still do them, 400 to maybe pushing 1,000 for some of them these days, but that's for something with, you know, tone that you can't get for any amount of money, right? Because we're using old parts and old transformers and old circuits, and those are old amps, even though I restore them so that they work like they're new. They're vintage as hell, right? So,
do guitar guys use those too?
Oh yeah, heck yeah! Lots of guitar guys, lots of at home guys. I build a lot of little 5 and 10 watt PA heads for guys that have like a deluxe reverb, and they put that on top of their cab and they run it through the speaker that they already have, and they get to experience the cool, like, single-ended amp thing where they're so sustaining when they're still clean, not distorted. They just go, bah. And some guys who want a PA head have never had a really good old amp or never had a small amp. They always had something too loud. And whatever I build them, they melt down because it's just cool. It's like they're like tweed amps, right? That's what they are. Fender didn't invent a guitar amp, right? The Masco brand in particular is almost identical to one of my favorite Fenders, which is the TV Front Pro. And the circuit in those PA heads is almost exactly the same, and the transformers are almost exactly the same, and the voltage is almost exactly the same. And I used to buy that stuff just to use for parts, but once I got enough schematics and enough knowledge, I started restoring them, and I trusted my own ears enough to say, dude, that sounds like a 1950 Tweed Pro. Right? It just does. And there was a time when I would give them to people and say, here, give me $100 if you like it, you know. But now I hardly ever have any of those built unless somebody has asked for it. I just kind of keep it on the low key. But I have 250 more in my building, right? Probably.
You've always had a pretty good inventory.
Well, that's because I don't push it, you know? I don't say, here, check this out. Try this. For one thing, some people just look at that stuff and they're just not going to dig it, no matter what. And they're not going to believe their own ears if they hear it, so don't bother. So I just wait for people who are hip and or inspired for some reason to get into that kind of thing. And, of course, if I build something like that for someone and they don't like it, I don't tell them too bad. I'd build them something else. I'd give them all their money back, whatever. So you can't try it beforehand. You got to trust me. But really, it's still pretty low risk because I'm not gonna have you. Nobody has anything like that that I made that they don't like. Right? That's the idea. It's got to be something that people flip for, or what's the point? My stuff, I want people to flip. I don't want them to just go, eh. I want them to call me in a few days and go, man, I'm playing more guitar now than I ever have. And I go, good, that's what I wanted. So that's the goal, not for pros. But pros need stuff that's really reliable. They don't take PA heads. But guys that just work out every day, their goal is to plug something in and stop messing with the knobs and stop screwing with their pedal and just turn it on, even if they only have 10 or 15 minutes to play, and get something going. Right? That's the goal for those people.
Sure.
And I tell them that. I say, that's what you need. Because they'll tell me, oh, I only play electric out in the garage on the weekends when my wife's gone. I'm like, no. You need a 5-watt amp right by the couch. You need a $200 Mexican Telecaster on a stand right there. And they call back and they say, you know, I'm playing half hour, 20 minutes every single day now. Thank you. Because I gave them the thing that would work for that. Trust me, if they were trying to do that with a super reverb or some big loud amp, it's just not going to be happening. All right? You know, same thing in hi-fi. You're not going to smoke a joint, sit in the couch, and listen to Pink Floyd on your big stereo very often. But when I'm down in the shop, I got a beautiful little mono tube amp going into an old Carlson enclosure, playing some cool jazz and rock and blues and stuff all the time. In some ways, you need something convenient that you can use all the time, not a dream rig. And a lot of guitar players, they buy gear for something they're never really going to do. Oh, next year, I'm going to find some guys and we're going to start playing out. Probably not. And in the meantime, you're saddling, you bought a logging truck and you're not logging and the thing's hard to park. It sucks the gas, right? And if they'd have just got a Toyota truck, it would have been a lot handier, right? So people need to be realistic about that. That's why all those little amps are so popular, because they sound better where most of us are using them. Not that many of us are professional musicians anymore, you know?
You mentioned 5 watts. Is 5 watts kind of the minimum you would go, or what do you think about these, like, 1-watt amps?
No, that's far as you go. 166 or 160Q5 is as small as we go. I don't roll with any of those AC/DC amps that use the 50C5 and the 35L6. So it's like some of the cheapest silver tone amps. To me, those are just barely worth it. Give me 5 watts. Give me 166 and a power transformer. Right? I don't like those ones with no power transformer.
Got it.
Because they never sound that good, and you can get a hellacious shock off of those things if you're not careful.
And if somebody orders one of these vocal PA heads from you, do you tweak it differently if the end user is a guitar guy versus a harp guy?
That's all custom. That thing's signed by me and has their name in it. I've done bands where they wanted to have all the microphones and they wanted to use the PA like it was made, right? And there's lots of pictures of cowboy bands playing, and there's the Masco sitting up there, and all the microphones, and maybe even electric mandolin or something. They're all plugged into it, right? I do that for people. Even most people don't do that; they just want something for themselves. But I make it for that guy, you know. I don't go Dumble and make the guy send me a recording of his playing and stuff like that. But you got to get into the ballpark. You ask him what he has, what he's like, you know, what he wishes he could afford, you know, where is he going to play, what kind of music is he into, and that gives you a pretty good idea. And most of that stuff is so versatile that if it's restored and tweaked up the way I do them, then most people are going to be really happy with the sound of it. Yeah, so I definitely do them different. I have a few favorites that I leave the same. The harmonica modifications I do, I left alone because Rick Estrin told me this is perfect. I can't even play the harmonica really, right? So I just leave that, you know. But you got to listen to those guys. If a pro brings me an amp, I don't say, hey man, you got to change this if he loves it, right? Once I fixed an amp for Rick, that was the guy that played in Muddy Waters' band, a white harmonica player. He was really good. And he had this broken amp, and I fixed it, and he hated it. He made me put the 100K resistor that read like 2 million ohms back in the amp, even though it was broken, because that's what he wanted, and that's what he's used to. And I'm not going to argue with a guy who played with Muddy Waters. I'm just going to say, okay, dude, right? I'll put it back that way for you if you want, right? So got to give it up for guys that play out, you know, for money. There are a lot of different customers than guys that I'm trying to give them something that's going to inspire them to play more electric guitar. Right? Just like I build a little tiny hi-fi amp for a guy because I want him to listen to music. I only listen to my big Fisher rig, I don't know, once a month. But the small thing that's convenient that you can have on while you're working right next to your computer or right there in the kitchen, that's the thing. And then before long, the guy's saying, yeah, man, I bought a whole box set of stacks and I've been listening to records all while we're cleaning. And again, that's the goal, to get some music going, not just dream about some big old gigantic rig that you're only going to use every couple of months.
For sure.
Right. I can't even remember what it was, but I know I built you some tube hi-fi thing way back there. Some little office hi-fi headphone amp or something like that.
I still have that. I still have the little Tysco 1-watt amp you sold me and the Fisher 400C.
Yeah. Well, that's people got to realize what they need. It's not always what they want. You know, and I can't believe it, but people are still floored when I tell them that all that Led Zeppelin stuff was a super low amp. And I thought everybody knew that, but I guess only geeks who read magazines know it. But, you know, dude, I want a Marshall. And I go, really? You mean like on Whole Lot of Love and Stairway to Heaven? The guy goes, yeah, man. I go, well, that's like a 10-watt super low amp and a Telecaster, not, you know, a 59 Les Paul. And yet, those records define that sound, the humbucking and the Marshall cab and all that, that it's definitive. But Page couldn't have got that tone at Wembley Stadium with the Supro, right? It's the place you're doing it and stuff. And lots of guys have brought me 50-watt Marshalls and wanted me to modify them so they sounded better in their apartment, and I refused to do it. Say, nope, service it, fix it, sell it. Get something that's really going to do what you're talking. Try one of these or one of these or one of these. I think that's another difference from amp repair guys, is they'll do whatever stupid thing the guy asks them to do. Change every single resistor and capacitor in this beautiful brown pro for me. The guy says, okay. If they said that to me, I'd say, no, these are all fine. Listen to it. Sounds awesome. So I try to make repairs as little as possible. And some people, maybe it's because they don't have enough work, they want it to be as much as possible, and they don't have enough respect for the actual thing. Sometimes I fix the amp, not necessarily the guy. like, if I've got just the right part and I can put it in there. And I just said, nah, I don't care if this guy doesn't want to spend an extra $10 on doing it anyway, because it's what needs to be done to this whole thing. If it's here and the guy went through the effort to get it to me, I like to do everything I can to optimize the thing if possible.
Have you played around with Filmosound projectors? I know that's one of the more hipster things to do these days, is convert those.
Now I can go wild. A few cheapskates who got into fixing up PAs and Filmosounds and stuff realized that those little amps are pretty close to a Tweed Deluxe in a lot of ways. And then somebody did some for some famous guys. I'm not exactly sure who that guy is, but there's some guru of the Filmosound. Personally, I don't touch those things. Look inside of one of those. They're just a nightmare to work on. I got 100 266 amps that I'd much rather fix up than one of those, and they'll sound just as good. Right? The little Hammond amps, that's what Goodsell started with. A lot of guys started making these little 18-watt Marshall clone things out of these little Hammond reverb amps that come from Leslie's. Right? Just good iron. But those the Filmosound amps are just crammed in there with a whole bunch of stuff that you don't need that's part of the projectors. So, no, I don't do Filmosound amps. I'd much rather restore a Newcomb little 266 amp or a Stromberg Carlson or something that was made as a PA, because it's going to be closer to what we want and easier to work on. I'm lazy. Those things, they just look like you took parts and just pushed them in there and then stepped on it and put some more in there and stepped on that, and you squeeze as many parts in that little chassis as you can get. And I'm sure that if you do a good job restoring one, it's going to kick butt. But all the stuff I do kicks butt, and I'd just rather not work on something quite that small, right, and tight. But it shows you that a lot of people have never heard a good old simple tube circuit, and, you know, a Filmosound or whatever. If you get that thing working and play it for a guy who's been playing, you know, big PVs or Mesa Boogies all his life, a lot of people just go, damn, that sounds good. Right?
Yeah,
I got
for
one
sure.
guy, much better sound than the Matchless I've been using. And this was like a single-headed Masco that put out 8 watts. And this is a pro. What's that guy's name? I can't remember, but he's a pro. So it's, again, you got to give somebody something that just makes them smile as soon as they, you know, hit the first chord. And depends on where they're going to be doing it, is that a big stage or what? And yeah, that was Dean Wareham. Dean Wareham, he's a really
from Galaxy 500.
You know, yeah, Galaxy 500. Yeah, you know him. He I built him a little Masco, and he loves it. And he became really good friends with my son Will, because they befriended him. He and his trippy wife Britta, right? And they do, like, really far out, you know, type of stuff. And he moved to L.A., and he has a little preamp I built him and a little Masco, and he's the guy that said, much better sound than the Matchless I've been using, which wouldn't be true if you were at the gig, but it was absolutely true at his house, because those amps just lay there when you crack them up. They don't do the response that we're looking for. So, there.
All right.
So, there. I still do a lot of that stuff.
Any parting words for us, Skip? Advice? Anything we didn't cover? Do's or don'ts?
I think I still tell people every single day how to clean the tube sockets in an amp. And I think guys that are going to have some old stuff, they can't be, if I don't want them going in there and deciding to change the 2 or 3 prong cord and updating the capacitors and crap like that. But a little basic maintenance. And once in a while, you know, like an old car guy doesn't even know how to pop the hood. You got to at least be able to check the oil on your old MG, right? And cleaning tube sockets and little things like that, cleaning pots, is the kind of thing that people can do themselves. And I explain how to do that on the phone for free every day, because noise and intermittence are a big problem with 50-year-old amps. And a lot of times, if you just go in and clean the preamp tube sockets a little bit, well, tons of the problems go away, right? Which leads me back to my repair philosophy, which is you brought me a car and you said the brakes were bad, we wouldn't jump in it, go down a hill, and slam on the brakes. If somebody sends me an amp, I don't turn it on. I don't even want to know what it does now. Wrong, screwed up. What I do is I do my thing to it first. So you got a super noisy Fender amp, and oh, it could be the capacitors, and maybe a transformer's going out. Well, I service the amp, clean the tube sockets, clean the pots, check the grounds. Now all those noises are gone. If you go the other way, you can really chase your tail. The guy that brought me all those vintage Ampegs, he was hoping I could just whip a few of them out real quick without taking them apart and really servicing them. And in a couple of cases, maybe it's this. Really, you should have just not done it that way and just started by checking the oil in the car, checking the battery terminals, are they tight? Just, is there gas in the tank? All the little things like that. If you don't do that stuff first, it makes diagnosing really hard. A scope isn't going to help you if your tube sockets are dirty and your amp is noisy. It's just not. So a little bit of maintenance is, learn a little bit of maintenance. Pretty much everything I've ever printed, like when I did the Skips Tips and Vintage Guitar, it was all stuff like that. You know, people go, oh my God, I can't put an 8-ohm speaker on my 4-ohm amp. It'll blow up. That's bullshit. Hook it up. Speakers can handle, you know, good amp can handle 100% mismatch. No problem. We know it from evidence, and I can show you the specs. And just things like that that they don't want to try to experiment a little bit with that can really make a big difference in the sound. You should hear a little Tweed Champ hooked up to a 112 cabinet with a P12R in it. Even though it's an 8-ohm speaker and a 4-ohm amp, it just kills the sound of any little 8. But yet people would go, oh my God, you're going to blow the transformer. No. Check the fuse, baby. Don't have too big of a fuse in your amp and you're not going to blow the transformer. Guys want to they want to sound smart and they want to, you know, be the voice of doom. You know, you can't just run that old amp because it could just blow up at any minute. It's like a time bomb. How could that be, man? I've seen so many old amps that are just ticking away and running fine. They need some love, but they still work. And it's just obvious if you've seen enough stuff that a lot of the jive on the internet is just that. It's like hypothetical jive, like the standby switch, and you got to have vintage tubes, and you got to have a grounded cord. But I was the guy that said, you don't have to have a grounded cord. But by the way, I've used 700 grounded cords in the last 5 years. So that's the guy. I'm the guy telling you don't need a grounded cord. But I'm also the guy telling you that I put 700 of those babies on amps in the last 5 years. That's just amps that needed a new grounded cord. So sure, I put them on lots of stuff, but that doesn't mean you put it on everything, right? You just got to look at things on a one at a time level. You can't just make these gigantic rules that are supposed to apply to everything. Recap it, whatever that means. Grounded cord, all new tubes, $400. That's what most people tell people when they have a Fender amp. Shit, they might already have better tubes than the stuff they're going to put in there, right?
Sure.
And if it's a blackface amp, it doesn't need all those capacitors replaced. People are paying $20 a piece for those, and you're going to take them out? What's the matter with you? Right? And thanks. You're doing a good job, and your mag is just fab and just head and shoulders above all the other crap I see. I can hardly read any of the other stuff.
All right, that was my talk with the one and only amp repair guru, Skip Simmons. Like I said, we're going to be launching a new podcast series with Skip where you can post your questions to him. It's called The Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons. I love an interview where I can just ask a question and sit back for 10 minutes listening to the answer. So this is going to be an easy podcast for me to pull off, but we are going to need your questions. Shoot them to us at fretboardjournal@gmail.com and we will post those to Skip for you.